What is the state of the media and climate change? That is the subject of an expert panel assembled by the University of British Columbia School of Journalism and dsmogblog.com. This segment is the discussion between the panelists. That's about 17 minutes. The speaker are James Hogan, a public relations expert who founded dsmogblog to counter phony experts paid by the fossil fuel industry. Also, Hadi Dalla Tabadi, professor at the Institute for Resources, Environment and Sustainability at UBC, who acknowledges that 10% of his million-dollar funding comes from ExxonMobil. Ross Gelbspan, a seasoned investigative reporter and author of Boiling Point, is on the panel, as is Chris Mooney, journalist and author of The Republican War on Science. Finally, we have Kirk Lapointe, managing editor of the Vancouver Sun, the city's largest newspaper and part of the CanWest chain in Canada.
Thank you, Kirk, and all the panelists. Before we go out to questions, I have a couple of questions for the panelists. I'll direct them individually to individual panelists, but if others want to jump in, that's fine, too. Hadi, you seem to suggest that both scientists and journalists have their own interests, their own agendas, and therefore are not to be completely trusted on these issues. If that's the case, how does the public know who to trust in this whole debate?
The question that's been put to me is, how do you know who to believe? Mm. There is a lot of trust involved in any kind of a belief situation. You tend to develop relationships with whoever the reporter is, who the scientists are, who their voice is, whether they speak to what you believe in your heart. So there are two models that you might apply. You know, is it a rational actor, you know, line of argument, or an emotionally appealing one? Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, the emotionally appealing approach seems to actually win over more converts than the rationally argued one. And, you know, my own preference is a well-argued articulation of the issues, but I know that the majority of the audience and the majority of the population are swayed much more effectively with something that's emotionally appealing. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that they have the truth. It means that they have something that they themselves internally feel trustworthy.
Does anyone want to add to what he had to say? No? Okay.
The one response I have, and I don't know how Hadi will respond to this, but from my point of view, the process of peer review is extremely important. And when you have new findings come out, and it is reviewed by other scientists in the field who have similar backgrounds of expertise, and I know from personal experience, many of these scientists have huge egos, and they would be like nothing better than to shoot down other people's work. And when a piece of work survives that process, that to me strikes me as something that we can then go ahead and believe, unless there's future evidence that comes up that also survives peer review that contradicts it.
Do you think I could? May I give a personal example?
Sure.
May I?
Yes.
Ross's good friend, let's call him PE, is a very well respected voice in the media about the health effects of climate change. He is not in the scientific community such a peer respected figure. Right? So I think going back to your question, the issue is, am I talking about appealing to the general public in terms of information carried by media about a problem such as climate change? Mm-hmm. PE is an extremely well-respected voice in the media. Mm-hmm. He is not in the peer community.
Chris, did you want to say something?
Yeah, if I may occupy perhaps something of a middle ground here. I mean, I think that without a doubt, the scientific community, all communities of people have various kinds of biases that exist, and you're never going to stamp them out completely because this is just human nature. The peer review process is set up to catch that kind of thing. Sometimes it fails, okay? Sometimes actually fraudulent work gets published. Sometimes work gets published that's very sensational, and then later it is challenged and doesn't survive the process. I think the best we can do in an imperfect world is not just actually look at one study. You never take one study, even if it's been peer reviewed, as eternal truth. If you sit back and let time pass and larger scientific assessments survey the peer-reviewed literature in its entirety, which is what the National Academy of Sciences does or what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change does, and they look at all the literature and then they haggle it out, then you're starting to get something that is reliable and that is, I think, policy relevant. and that's what I'd prescribe.
Kirk?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to deal with myths of journalism, and one of them is that somehow journalism publishes the truth. It pursues the truth. It usually prints or broadcasts at deadline what it believes in its heart is true, and then it wakes up the next morning and sees if, in fact, it's holding. And if it's not holding, it does its best to scramble and to try to revise and revamp. Journalism's so often described as the first draft of history, but I'm not even sure that, you know, that's fair to history. You've really got to be careful about this notion of why don't you guys publish the truth. The fact is that, yes, we do depend a great deal on officialdom for the sweep that we have to make over society in order to pick the right points, in order to frame the material that we're going to publish on a given day. And some of those role players aren't all that nice at times, and there's a lot behind the curtain. But peer-reviewed journals now seem to be the standard by which most responsible media organizations are basing their science coverage. I will say, however, that yes, there are lots of self-promoting scientists who will attempt to leak material and who will attempt to bypass that or say, I'm going to get this through, it's only a matter of time, here's the result. And I can tell you that it's far more hazardous on the health frontier than it is on the earth sciences frontier. Mm-hmm. I think we're far more dangerous in media in publishing claims of cures of illnesses and diseases. And I think that has to go away really soon, because I think we've lost so much of our audience to an incredible kind of coverage over the last 15 years as more and more scientists become more shameless self-promoters.
Keep the microphone, because the next question's for you, Kirk. What I heard here was several people talking about manipulation of journalists, manipulation of news organizations, whether it be a clash of interest, a clash of interest, or it's perhaps the ability to use journalists to get your message out, and so on and so forth. I mean, we know that. We know that manipulation and those attempts at manipulation are going on and have gone on for a long time in journalism. Did they happen in the climate debate? And if so, why can't we weed that out of newsrooms?
I think we're weeding it out, but I think, Stephen, it's like we are overrun by people seeking publicity. I mean, what is information if not publicity about someone's business or someone's cause or someone's profile? And, you know, the number of opportunities for us to glom on to that kind of publicity machine every day is, I mean, we can do nothing but. And I know people snickered at Britney Spears' shaved head, but I also know that pretty well everyone read the story. So, like, you're laughing at yourselves. It's kind of, you know, the truth is that there are huge vested interests in this, and we did not detect them sufficiently at times. We didn't apprehend that behind this debate was actually vested economic interest that had the same potent potential as the tobacco controversy a generation and a half ago, the thalidomide controversy, any number of things.
Right.
And so, you know, why haven't we done it? Well, Stephen, I mean, one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons is of a journalist facing a dartboard, and there are a bunch of faculties on the dartboard, law, medicine, science, and the journalist is with the dart pointing, saying, today I am an expert in,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It is because so many of our newsrooms have general purpose journalists and don't have specialization in it. And I think if we're going to save ourselves, we're going to have to get back to an era of specialization. It means that we're going to have to drop some things, because resources will not sustain us to do all the things that we've been able to do. But we are going to have to find people who are expert in what, in the narrow thing that we want them to cover, and right, just have them cover the hell out of it. Right. And stop trying to blandize and generalize what we're doing in journalism today.
Ross, I wonder if you could just speak to this point. You seem to suggest, if I get your language correctly, an abdication of responsibility to look into this clash of interest. Was this a deliberate, explicit decision not to abdicate responsibility? Or is this some other more routine way the media works that accounts for this abdication of responsibility, if I'm not misquoting you?
It's a very good question, Stephen. I think partly it is the fact that in the issue of climate, it is by nature off the charts. It's very frightening. It's very overwhelming. And I think journalists and reporters and editors are subject to the same kinds of feelings as the general public. And when they are confronted with what seems like an overwhelming threat and they don't see an intellectually honest solution, it makes them feel impotent and they don't want to deal with it. And so I really think that's a little bit of the psychology. I'd like to use my time real quickly just to respond to something that Hadi said before. And when Hadi introduced himself and declared that his work was being funded by ExxonMobil in part, a percentage of his work.
10%.
Whatever percent. One thing that I was not able to say because of the time constraints is when I was talking about journalists whose work was funded covertly by the fossil fuel lobby, to me, the issue of disclosure is of primary importance. Because if a scientist says his work is funded by, let's say, ExxonMobil or Peabody Coal or whoever, that at least allows that work to be scrutinized for possible commercial bias. In the case of the skeptics that I was talking about, and in particular one that Jim has done a great deal of work with on the DeSmog blog, mm-hmm. And many of the other skeptics, they have kept this hidden. So for example, I'm thinking of a man named Fred Singer, and Fred Singer was challenged about his funding. He wrote a letter in the Washington Post and said, in which he said, I have not received any money from the oil industry for 20 years. Okay, this was in 2001. It turns out that Fred Singer got $75,000 from ExxonMobil in 1998. And the reason I happen to know that is that it was on ExxonMobil's website. So to me, the issue of disclosure is very important. And I have no issue with scientists who say, part of my work is funded by commercial interests. That means it is open to review for possible commercial bias. And I simply wanted to make that clarification in terms of what I
think. Thank you.
I know it's off point of your question.
Great. No, but I have one more question for James, and then I'm going to let then I'm going to ask you whether you want to respond to anything else that's been said. James, in your presentation, the one thing that struck me was that it seems that some polls show that many Canadians were not totally certain that human activity contributes to climate change. Those who are very concerned about climate change right now are quite happy that it's at the top of concerns of Canadians. But you also suggested that that could change if in fact the understanding of that issue is not deep enough, if it's not based on a good understanding of the problem. What I'm saying is the possibility that this issue could drop from number one to number four tomorrow? Is it that volatile, the public opinion?
I don't know about tomorrow, but I would say that the qualitative research, which is basically focus group type research that I've seen on what it is that people, we know that a growing number of Canadians are worried about climate change. And when you start to ask them what they're worried about, it kind of breaks down. And they're not actually quite sure if it has something to do with a hole in the ozone, or if you ask Canadians in focus groups, what do you think should be done about climate change? Often people will say that it has something to do with recycling. And it does to a certain degree, but so I don't think it's quite true to say that the issue is a mile wide and an inch deep, which is something you hear in my industry quite a bit. But it certainly isn't. It's very easy to overestimate people's concern about it, because if they don't understand what it is, it's easy for it to be replaced by something. And if they're concerned about it for the wrong reasons. I mean, we don't know if what happened in Stanley Park, I mean, you could answer this question, had anything to do with climate change, but I think most scientists would suggest that that would be a stretch. But a lot of people might be worried about climate change because of what was happening in Stanley Park and various other, 75 degrees in Central Park on January 9th is something, they just look at it and they are worried, but maybe for the wrong reason. So as, I don't know who it was who said, the weather gets better, everybody changes their mind. That's why I'm so concerned about the nature of the way that it's covered. I think the research that I've seen, Canadians are basically saying, we want to hear scientists tell us what's going on. They'd rather not hear the political rhetoric. They don't believe business. They think business says one thing and does another. They think politicians do the same thing. But they basically trust scientists. And I don't think it's because they're emotional. I think it's because they trust scientists because, you know, they see them as having less of an agenda as some of the other spokespeople on the issue have.
Is there any other thing that, does anyone want to say? Go ahead.
If I could ask a question, follows up on Kirk's observation with respect to the importance of the visual media having something to shoot in order to then galvanize the public attention around the climate change issue and the tragedy of storms around here, providing that visual backdrop. One of the concerns I've had is that let's say that this period of heightened interest lasts long enough for reasonable policies to be implemented. One of my concerns is that the public's resolve may be weakened when, after they perceive some kind of sacrifice, we continue to have visually arresting images of storms and storm damage, because that's what initiated it. They're going to ask, well, I sacrificed, what's happened here? So I would love to hear the audience, the panelists, kind of give some maybe personal or experienced wisdom on whether there is any validity to my concern about using that as the trigger for activity and then perhaps not falling afoul of the same trigger as being the reason for people saying to hell with this.
Well, yeah, there's absolutely massive concern because you can't blame any one event on global warming, so it's just inaccurate. And I don't think we should be misleading the public. And if we're worried about, you know, fossil fuel interests misleading the public, then we should also be worried about environmentalists misleading the public if they're going to make a scientifically untenable connection between one event and global warming. And, you know, the latest consensus statement from the scientists on hurricanes and global warming says a lot of things, and there's a lot that they don't know, and that's mostly what it says. One of the things that they do know is that they say no single hurricane can be blamed on climate change. So now, that's not to say that the issue of global warming cannot be brought up in the context of a single event, but it has to be done in a very nuanced way, to be intellectually honest.
You have been listening to an expert panel debating the state of the media and climate change. The speakers were James Hogan, a public relations expert who founded desmogblog.com, Hadi Dawlatabadi, professor, Institute of Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at UBC, Ross Gelbspan, reporter and author of Boiling Point, Chris Mooney, journalist and author of The Republican War on Science, and Kirk Lapointe, managing editor of the Vancouver Sun, the city's largest newspaper. Visit the University of British Columbia School of Journalism site at www.journalism.ubc.ca and Desmogblog at desmogblog.com. This was recorded by Paul Donovan of Focus Audiovisual and Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. All five presentations by the panelists, their discussion among themselves, and the question and answer period for this event are available for free download from www.ecoshock.org.